So generosity, so lovely subject to be talking about. Because you can't really do anything wrong with generosity, or can you? So generosity, I mean, Sadaloka mentioned, it's one of the perfections, and it's also one of these means of unification that he talked about yesterday. So this week we're looking at generosity and ethics. Sirita will talk about ethics tomorrow. And there are six of them, six of these perfections, and if I can just run them off easily off the top of my head, they are generosity and ethics and patience and energy and concentration or meditation and wisdom. So those of you that are here next week, you'll hear about the others, but this week we're just looking at generosity and ethics. So I've been thinking about these, I mean, they're called perfections. That's one translation of the term paramita. So, and generosity is quite a good translation of dana. So this is dana paramita, the perfection of generosity. And I've been thinking about, well, just these six perfections in general. They come up in other lists as well. You know, there are different numbers of them, but these six are quite classic in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. And I think of them as a way, well, they're a set of practices, of aspirations. But they're also, if you like, they're a set of characteristics. So I was thinking of when Sadaloka was talking about the Buddha field and the Buddha land yesterday. You can think of as the people who are in, whoever they are, in this Buddha field, that these are their characteristics. They have perfected, so they just like this kind of wonderful sort of characteristics of perfection of generosity and ethics and so on. So what I'm going to do in looking just at generosity, what I want to do is to tell you about some ways in which I see generosity operating in the everyday world, ways that I've come across. I'd even call some of them conundrums, ways that I've seen generosity. And then I want to look at what this perfection of generosity tradition says about generosity and how it's to be practiced. And I think there's something interesting for me that I think a retreat kind of can fit in. It's like a kind of halfway house between, you know, what we do and how we act in the everyday world and this kind of Buddha field or Buddha land that Sadaloka talked about yesterday. So, you know, you have a kind of a place where it's sort of perfected, if you like. You have a place where people are trying to do something in the nature of generosity. And then on a retreat, it's like this kind of working ground, if you like, this kind of halfway house. And I find this idea quite inspiring and something about it that so you can be in touch with an ideal, but you don't kind of get too disillusioned that it's so far away. We're still kind of the world, as it were. You know, we're still kind of the world. So the four things that I want to talk about, I'm just going to go through them one after another, and then I'll kind of say what this, what the perfection of generosity literature, to give it that name, says about them. So the first one is the giving of material things. I think we all know that generosity doesn't just mean material things, but at the same time we live in such a material world, you know, and things and objects and the sense by which we see things, you know, it's so important to us. I mean, and there is something I think not to be ignored in the giving of tangible objects and money. I think it's really important, and I'll say more about it later. So on the one hand, you know, material things, it's kind of like the beginning, the starting point. But on the other, it's also something never to be forgotten, in a way. I want to say more about the other three things, though, that I've picked up on. And the second one of those is the idea of reciprocity, the idea that you give something with an expectation of receiving something. And I think this I want to be able to say this without giving too much of a value judgment to it, because I think it's just an almost, you could say, inevitable in our practice of generosity. So, that when we give something, we don't necessarily expect the same kind of thing back, but we might expect something, even if it's quite subtle, even if it's unconscious, and that might be some affirmation, some personal affirmation, or it might be some status. It could be lots of different things. But reciprocity is, I think it's a very interesting subject. I came across it first. Well, I started to think about it first when I was studying international relations. And I came across it in the work of an American academic called Robert Axelrod. And he wrote a book called The Evolution of Cooperation. And it was about reciprocity and the basis on which people can perform generous actions. And it was based on something called game theory, which some of you would have probably have come across, and an aspect of game theory that's called prisoner's dilemma. Has anyone heard of that? Yeah. So I'll just I'll tell you briefly what prisoner's dilemma is, because the outcomes of his research were, I found them really quite interesting. Prisoner's dilemma was, it was some mathematicians that came up with it in the 1950s. And it was this idea, you had two prisoners, and you're never told whether they've actually committed a crime or not, but the dilemma for them is they're separated by their jailers or their interrogators or whatever, and they have to decide whether they confess or not. Because if both of them don't confess, then there's no other evidence to convict them. But if one of them confesses and the other one doesn't, then the one who doesn't will get convicted. So, and if they both confess, then obviously they both get convicted, but at a lesser punishment or something. That was the basis of prisoner's dilemma anyway. So in other words, it was trying to establish on what basis could cooperation develop given that kind of scenario. And it may sound quite abstract, but it was actually used in the development of the American nuclear deterrent strategies throughout the 1950s and 60s. And what Robert Axelrod did, he took this idea of prisoner's dilemma, and he wasn't the only one, lots of other people were using it. It turned up in economics and social policy, and I'll give another example in a minute. But he set it up as a kind of repeated game, because he said, well, as humans, we're always interacting, and often our interactions, sometimes they're with strangers, but often they're with the same people. So how can you develop a kind of society where people would be generous, basically? That was what he was trying to get at. So he set up this game, and he asked people to submit. It was a computer game based on Prisoner's Dilemma, and he asked people to submit strategies. And they would all play this game together. And there's no need to go into kind of lots of detail to it, but what I found really interesting was the strategy that won was submitted by a guy called Anatole Rapoport, who was also an academic, and it was called tit for tat. It was the simplest strategy that was submitted. It started off, it said you cooperate first, and then after that you mimic whatever the other person does. So there's something very good in that. So you always cooperate first. In other words, you begin with an act of generosity. You know, if that act of generosity, it just gets thrown back in your face straight away, then the next time round you don't cooperate. But you always begin with cooperation. And it's been applied in various, as a way of explaining various types of action. I think one of the ones that Robert Axelrod gives is he uses it to explain cooperation in the trenches in World War I, for example. But there was something I found very reassuring about that, because in a world where, they start off from a premise which is, how to establish trust. But he says you always it's cooperate first. Cooperate first. So there is something in that, though, that disturbed me, and this is going on to the third point, if you like, and that's to do with generosity and the concept of the individual. Because what this what these strategies were based on was an idea of the individual as selfish, and I was never completely happy with that somehow, you know, as a kind of starting point. You know, I mean, the clue is there right from the beginning of the prisoner's dilemma, that you're two prisoners. They're just saying these are ordinary people, these are humans, if you like, but they call them prisoners, you know, in jail. So it says that it's starting off on the premise of being selfish. And, I mean, it hasn't been game theory. I mean, it wasn't just about nuclear deterrence strategy. I mean, it's also come up. I mean, I see it coming up in our culture, in this country, in public services, in what's called target-driven culture. The premises that is used in, I mean, Dave can probably say something about this in the police force, but my stepbrother's in the police force and my mum worked in the health service for 30 years. And you know, I just get these, you know, they have this kind of target-driven culture now, which is based on the premise, the same premises that were used in game theory, which is like individuals cannot be trusted just to be naturally generous. We have to actually put targets in place which are on the premise of reward and punishment. I mean, they haven't only come from game theory. It's important to say that. I mean, you can look to... I also studied British politics years ago now. And Thomas Hobbes, in his great work of Leviathan of 1651 or something, it's a kind of a work that sets up the premises of a liberal state, but he bases it on a notion of individuals as seeking power to maximise their own, you know, selfish desires, if you like. It's a pretty negative conception, in a way, of an individual. But he says you need a strong government and a strong state in order to, you know, so that people just don't kind of like dominate other people. So, you know, it's not just, hasn't just come from, I wanted to say that because it hasn't just come from North American game theory. We tend to think lots of bad things come from North America. But there is something, something that kind of, I thought, well, it's not a very good starting point in a way, that, you know, surely individuals are more than that. And that, you know, you know, lots of aspects of our society and the way our kind of political system is set up would be based on this notion of an individual, of profit maximising, of, you know, of selfish seeking power. The fourth point I want to make about the kind of evolution, if you like, or the development of generosity, or how it's viewed in society, is connected with wisdom. And this comes from when I was working in development agencies, in NGOs, in the NGO world. What I saw around me was a lot of people who had this impulse of generosity, but the consequences of the agencies with which they were working seemed to be at best complex and at worst detrimental to the countries in which they were working. And I was very dissatisfied with this. In fact, I could quite quickly argue myself into the position where the best thing that we could do was to go home, you know, in terms of aid programs and conflict prevention and so on. And you know, I thought there was something here that people want to do. You know, there was really desires to sit down and talk with people. I worked at Amnesty and other NGOs and UN agencies and so on. And we'd sit down and you know, I could tell that, you know, those types of organisations attract people who really want to do some good in the world. And yet the consequences were just often not particularly good. And there was, you know, there was a kind of a lot of competitiveness as well between agencies, and within a particular country, you'd have kind of aid programs which would one might cancel out the effects of another one. Things like this that were going on, which were, I mean, obviously there were some basic poverty alleviation programs which were just really helpful about providing clean water and food supplies and, you know, shelter and so on for people. But I was not satisfied with what I found. In other words, actually, intention wasn't enough. Like, there was an intention to do good, but, you know, actually, you know, you needed something else. So they're the four things that I just picked out those out, really. It's my own kind of how I've seen generosity operating in the world. The one about the individual is almost like the assumptions on which it's based, if you like, on which and social policy, economic policy, a lot of them are based on that those kinds of assumptions of selfish individuals. So what I want to go on to now is to talk about how this perfection, I call it perfection literature, I quite like that little phrase, but how this Mahayana Buddhist idea of generosity and the Buddhist tradition in general, how it kind of looks at these particular four things. Let me just have a sip of water. What I'll do is I'll talk about reciprocity first. The Buddhist tradition would basically say it's good as far as it goes. In a way, it's okay. It's all right to give and to expect something in return, even if it's quite subtle. That would be a basic position. But, you can do a lot more, that you can go a lot further. And I just want to read a few verses. The first two are from Shantideva. I can't remember if Sadaloka quoted this first, but Shantideva was this 8th century monk in India. And this text, which is called the Bodhicharya Avatara, not all of you will have heard of it, I don't think. It's the sort of classic source for the Bodhisattva path. And not all of you would have heard of this term bodhisattva that Sadaloka mentioned. It means somebody, and it's a very important Buddhist concept of somebody practicing the Buddhist path with the altruistic intention. In other words, the benefit to help other people, wanting to help others, to benefit others. And this text, it comes up, it's quoted in so many places in the tradition, in the subsequent tradition, mainly in Tibetan Buddhism. But it's not the origin, but it's one of the core texts. So, on the I'm using these quotes to look at reciprocity. So this I'll just read out some of these. He says here, I make over this body to all embodied beings to do with as they please. Let them continually beat it, insult it, and splatter it with excrement. Let them play with my body. Let them be derisive and amuse themselves. I have given this body to them. What point has this concern of mine? I mean, it's an extraordinary statement. When I was reading these out and thinking to myself and thinking I'd like to read these to you, I can feel this impulse in me that I want to soften them. It just seems like the most unbelievable sort of thing to take seriously, in a way. I make over this body to all embodied beings to do with as they please. Let them continually beat it, insult it, and splatter it with excrement. I'll just, before I kind of comment on that, there's another source as well, which I often go back to, which is a Tibetan monk, Togme Gyaltso Sangpo, is how I think you say his name, from about the 12th century. And he's very much in the same tradition. And talking about this perfection of generosity, he says, it's almost a direct quote from Shantideva, actually, but he says, all suffering comes from the wish for your own happiness. Perfect Buddhas are born from the thought to help others. Therefore, exchange your own happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And then he goes on, I'll read two more verses where he goes into a bit more detail, if you like. He says, even if someone out of strong desire steals all your wealth or has it stolen, dedicate to him your body, possessions, and your virtue, past, present, and future. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And then the next verse is, even if someone tries to cut off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, out of compassion, take all his misdeeds upon yourself. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So I think you can see from these verses, I mean, they're quite strong verses, that they, you know, what he's doing is taking this idea of generosity, and he's just gone like way beyond reciprocity. You know, the next step, if you like, from reciprocity would mean being generous without expecting reward, you know, wouldn't it really? And then they've gone like the next step after that, which is being generous even if you get crap back, even if you get absolute, you know, someone who you've like devoted your life to, they might turn around and just like absolutely put it in your face and say, I don't want to thank you for anything at all. I think you've been terrible to me. Even that person, you would still act generously towards. And I mean, it is quite a strong teaching. And I think, I mean, one of the ways in which I hope I'm not going to tone it down here, but one of the ways in which I think about this is it's to do, and it's connected with ethics, I guess. And that is that when you have a set of practices, and the Buddhist tradition is very strong on having quite clear methods, what can happen quite quickly is that rather than use them as a way of kind of growing and developing ourselves, we use them as something by which to judge other people's conduct. You know, it's so common, like we have our precepts in the FWBO, 5 precepts and 10 precepts if you're an order member, it's almost a natural, almost inevitable thing that at some point, rather than applying these to yourself as a standard of conduct, you know, in a kind of healthy way, but you just use it to make judgments about other people, as a stick, if you like, to beat other people with. So I think one of the things these verses is pointing at is that tendency. They're just asking us to go beyond that. Because there's another verse in Shantideva which maybe makes that a little bit clearer. He says, I'll be a slave for those desiring a slave. And you think, well, hold on, you know, that's not a very good thing. I mean, it's not a good thing to be a slave, and it's not a good thing to desire a slave. But what he's saying there is, like, don't make judgment about the other people, that's somebody else's intentions. You know, just, you know, be generous yourself. And I think, just as a sort of commentary on that, I mean, there is a place where for us to question other people's actions, you know, but certainly within our movement and within our order, you know, we have these chapters, you know, where we meet together in small numbers, and I think that's the sort of place where over a long period of time, when you get to know somebody really well, then there's a place in which you might say, well, hold on a moment, you know, there's a place where you can come and confess and it be heard in a kind of responsible and sensible way, and there's a place where you can you might be able to question, you know, your friend's actions. You know, so that's the place. It's like when you've got to, you know, another place would be when you're living and working with people over a long period of time, you know, like somewhere like Padmanoka. But what these teachings about generosity are trying to tell us, though, is that you work on yourself. You know, you work on yourself. You just try and go beyond yourself. That's it. So this is a connected point, but I just want to look at wisdom, you know, because when I talked about working in the NGO world and, you know, seeing that people wanted to do good work or be generous, I mean, really, it was a lack of wisdom. That's what it came down to. When I first came across Sangharakshita, who's, you know, if you're in the FWBO or the order, he's our teacher. One of his early tape lectures, or one of the ones that I came across early, he said, you really need wisdom to do social work. And I think it was so good to hear that, and so important. And I think that because in Buddhism, there's a really good and strong emphasis on intention as a basis of ethics. But you see, I'd already come across that in my reading, but when my work, it's like, well, actually, you know, you need more than just intention. You know, here there were people, including myself, we all had an intention to do good, but you actually needed wisdom. You know, you actually needed more than that in order to know what was really helpful for people. And I mean, I'll just say something about, I mean, wisdom in the Buddhist tradition. I mean, really, I mean, if you like it, I mean, it's about, I mean, you know, there's phrases that we've probably all heard of about seeing things as they really are. I mean, what I take that to mean is, I mean, what the Buddha saw, as I understand it, was this kind of universal law of cause and effect. You know, that all things arise independent upon conditions, and all things cease when those conditions cease. You know, that was his great teaching. And everything else, if you like, is a commentary on that teaching. You know, everything is in process, everything is in flux. And when this is applied, when the Buddha applied this to the human realm, he said that, well, there are certain actions that you do that are conducive to happiness and well-being. And there are certain actions that we can do that will increase our fear and anxiety, if you like, you know, and to our detriment. Therefore, you know, and this set of perfections is one of these methods. The Buddha taught these practices as a way of conducing to happiness, to freedom from fear, from freedom from anxiety. So, you know, that, if you like, that's applying wisdom. That's what needs to be applied as much as we're able to. As much as we're able to get to, you know, that's how far back we need to go. You know, generosity is great, and that's because it's a practice, you know, that is conducive to our well-being, if you like. But it need to, you know, we need to take it as far back as to this kind of law of, or see this universal law of, you know, cause and effect, that all things are in process. It's such an easy thing to say, and it's such a hard thing to, you know, it's such a hard thing to actually see. You know, I mean, I came across it. I mean, 20 years ago, I think, and I just, I mean, I don't know how. Occasionally, on the middle of a retreat, you might just get a little glimpse where I think, oh, okay, that's what it means, that you get a glimpse of the world as being in complete process, and what I need to do, if you like, in order to kind of flow through the world without causing more problems than I'm solving. But it's, you know, it's a level of profundity that I can't say I really reach very often. I just want to say something as well about this concept of the individual that I had mentioned about that. So, you know, a lot of the, the life that we live in the world, a lot of the kind of economic and social policies which influence and affect us are based on this notion of an individual as selfish and, power seeking. And, one of the things I found... Well, when you look at the Buddhist concept of the individual, I mean, the first thing is that at the profoundest level, the individual just does not exist. You know, just this taking this, what I just said about cause and effect and process, that it says that there is no thing that you can call an individual. There's a set of processes and habits, if you like, that somehow stick together in a body, you know, but there is no thing as an individual. But at a little bit more, say, of a practical level than that, there's also... there's this image of the wheel of life, and at the centre of it there's a cockerel, a pig and a snake kind of chasing each other, and they represent greed, hatred and ignorance. So a kind of a cursory look at Buddhism, and you think, well, actually, maybe they're starting off in the same place, you know, saying that we're, you know, greedy and that we hate and that we're ignorant. But it's not actually quite saying that. It's what it's saying is that those are the things that cause us pain and suffering. They're not saying that they are what humans are, if you like. So it starts off at a much more, I would say, balanced view of what it means to be human. And that is that we have a capacity for great good and we have a capacity for great evil, and that we have some element of choice in order to decide which way we go. And then it gives us a set of practices to help us go down the side of good, if you like. So, I mean, there's also in Buddhism this wonderful idea. I mean, I really what's called Buddha nature, that there is a kind of innate purity somehow. And I like this idea to help us get away maybe from what you might call the miserable sinner tradition, the Christian church as it's otherwise known as. I mean, there's a lot of good things in Christianity, you know, and there's a wonderful liturgy in it as well. But it does start off, as far as I understand it, from this idea of original sin. And I suspect that, you know, works like Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan and even the premises that game theory is based on, you know, they also somehow pick up on this, you know, that's who we are. We're sinners at base. And in Buddhism, there's, you know, as the idea of Buddha nature, that there is, you know, you don't have to, well, just like this idea that we're innately pure and trying to work our way back to that. I mean, Sangharakshita says, as a sort of something to base your life on, he says it can be a little bit dangerous. It's not a teaching he's emphasised, because it can mean you get a bit lazy, I think, because you think you've already done everything. But anyway, it's a very nice concept, if you like, to put aside, you know, the kind of Christian tradition concept of a miserable sinner. So, and then the last thing I want to just go back to, if you like, was the first point I made, which was the giving of material things. And I want to go back to that because I want to place it in a hierarchy. There's in Buddhism, there's in this perfection of generosity literature, there's a hierarchy of generosity. And again, there are different lists. But in all of these lists, the first one is material things, giving material things. And as I think I mentioned before, but it stresses in the giving of material things, while it's better to give with a good intention, you know, just giving. It's almost like you're just creating a habit, an outward looking habit. So even if you're giving, you know, and you want or hope for some kind of reward, I mean, that's still a lot better than not giving. The tradition says that quite clearly. But the list I'm going to use actually comes from a wonderful work called The Words of My Perfect Teacher from Patril Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan Rinpoche from the 19th century. And it's a work that Dade Rinpoche, whose relics are in this stupa outside and was one of Sangharakshita's teachers, he would always recommend this text as the best overview of the Bodhisattva path. So Patril Rinpoche's list, there are three things in it. And the first one is this material giving. And then the second one, he says, giving the Dharma. And what this means is, I mean, in a way, it's giving the means to liberation. It's giving the means to overcome fear, giving the means to overcome anxiety. And, you know, in a sense, of course, I mean, that's the greatest gift of all. You're giving people the means for them to overcome suffering in their lives. You know, that's the most, you know, there's nothing higher than that in a way. But Patril Rinpoche, he then spends quite a lot of time in his commentary saying, just be careful with doing that. You actually need some deep understanding yourself before you can give the Dharma, in other words, the teachings of Buddha, to other people. There's a difference I think we can make between kind of giving instruction, if you like, and giving the kind of wisdom teachings. But anyway, he's very cautious. He says that giving the Dharma, if you don't yourself practice it wholeheartedly to a kind of a deep level of realization, it's like pouring water from an empty vessel. So anyway, he gives some warning there. But he does say it's the most important thing you can do. But the third thing that he says is the one that I find fascinating, and that is giving confidence. Giving confidence or fearlessness. And Sangharakshita, actually, in his great work, A Survey of Buddhism, which he wrote in, I think, the late 40s or early 50s, when he talks about the paramita of generosity in there, he calls it a uniquely Buddhist concept, this idea of giving fearlessness. And I mean, I don't know, I mean, I haven't come across it in other traditions, but I find it a really interesting idea. I've been reading, I've just lent a book to Dave, actually, Forest Recollections. Some of you might have come across it, which is the story of these wandering monks in Thailand. And I mean, they came from Thailand, and they also wandered in parts of Cambodia and Laos and Burma, or Myanmar, as it's now called. And these recollections are stories that come. It's a tradition that I think in this form has almost died out, but it was extant in the early part of the 20th century, and that's where these stories come from. And these wandering monks would just go about the villages. And one of the most important things that comes across again and again in their stories and their reports back from the villages was that they were able to give confidence and fearlessness to the villagers that they met. I mean, sometimes they taught them meditation, sometimes they... In fact, you get a bit of a flavour in some of the stories that they would come into a village, and although that often these villagers were in the jungle, but often the villagers were scared of the jungle. So they had a village, but they were really scared, and they thought that the jungle or the forest was inhabited by demons or... spirits or whatever, you know, malevolent forces. So when the monks would come into the village, the villagers would go, yeah, can you just go and, if you go and sleep over there in the middle of the jungle, come back in the morning and we'll give you a nice bowl of rice. You know, the monks would just go off and they would just... there's all these stories, extraordinary stories, that they would be there and they would meet tigers. Tigers would come up to them in the night, or, you know, some kind of, like, spirits would come and visit them, or they would see lights or, you know, whatever. But they were just... that was their practice, you know. So, I mean, it was their own journey, of course, as well, through fearlessness. And but it also, you know, they gave a lot of confidence to the villagers. There's a rather sobering story as well in there, in that... which is, you know, connected here in a way, which is that in some cases, what happened was that as the villagers became more confident and less fearful of the forest, so they went in and started cutting down the trees, and there's been a kind of deforestation over northern Thailand. I mean, one doesn't want to blame the monks for that, and one doesn't want to suggest in any way that you want to keep people in a state of fear so they don't go into the forest, but it just shows the complexity of you give people, you know, some confidence, and that it can have consequences which you don't intend, you really don't intend it at all, but has you know, has the consequences of, like, but in this case, deforestation. I mean, it also comes up in India as well. I was working there with Subhuti, who some of you won't know, but he's one of our senior order members, 2 years ago. And, you know, the so-called new Buddhist in India, they come from the lowest caste, well, the sort of even outside of the caste system. And so one of the most important things that Buddhism has given them has been a sense of confidence, you know, because they just feel like they've been at the bottom of the pile, and probably they're... parents, or certainly their grandparents, would have been the people that you hear about these stories in village India, where if there's a high caste person walking along the road and one of these low caste or Dalit people, they would jump in the ditch, you know, to get out of the way so that their shadow wouldn't pollute the high caste person walking along. So in that kind of scenario, you think, well, my goodness, you know, giving some confidence and so on to these people is just like the most extraordinary gift that you can do, really. You know, I mean, it's also teaching them Buddhism and the means for, you know, for them to end their suffering. But as I witnessed when we were in India, that also has these same kinds of effects that you just see there's a complexity there. Because when I was in Nagpur with Subhuti, there had been these killings of a Buddhist family, a Dalit family, in a village miles away. And the Buddhists in the city of Nagpur, they decided to riot as a protest. So, and they actually, they were so proud of themselves because they managed to shut the city down for 2 days. So it's this weird kind of situation that, they were proud of their, Buddhism gives them an identity which is outside of the caste system. So it gives them a kind of confidence and so on. But, they end up, having a big riot. And, I was in a rickshaw, in fact, one day, and this mob was running towards me, like, with sticks and stones. It's the most frightening thing you can possibly imagine, actually. And it didn't seem the right time to kind of stand up and go, hello, I'm a Buddhist too, and I'm here to help you. Just, you just sort of get out of the way. But anyway, this just shows the complexity, I think, of helping people. However, that aside, giving people the gift of fearlessness, and there is something, I think we all know it, when we're around a confident person, it's wonderful. I feel it. I feel more confident myself when I'm around confident people. It's the most wonderful kind of atmosphere to be able to exude, if you like. It's a kind of a realm of positivity, and I do think of it in terms of in terms of this Buddha field or Buddha land, that it's people who can give that kind of fearlessness and confidence that makes everything else possible. It's a lot easier to act generously, to act ethically, to all of these things if you're actually feeling kind of robust in yourself. There's also another very interesting thing here as well, which is that, giving or becoming confident in yourself, thinking of it as an act of generosity, well, it's something that you do, you can practice it, on your own. All of Sangharakshita's teachers spent, or at least almost all of them, spent long times in periods of solitary meditation. So it's not like generosity means that you always have to be around, interacting with people. It's almost as if, in fact, you could say that whatever you do yourself that benefits yourself in the sense of giving you more confidence is also an act of generosity for whoever else you come across. Obviously, in there's room for kind of rationalization and so on. So the caveat is it needs to be done with the right attitude. You're becoming a kind of more robust person yourself in order to benefit others. And as long as you're kind of keeping that in mind, I think all motives sort themselves out. So I think that's, I think that's the most important thing I feel I could say to you. Certainly that's been one of the most useful things for me to come across. I find it fascinating, this idea of fearlessness as an act of generosity. But, I think that, also just going back to the idea, one of the early ideas I talked about of reciprocity, just giving is good even if you're expecting reward. Motives sort themselves out. Any outward movement. I mean, it's just, basic metta bhavana type teaching that any outward looking in a kind of, with the intention of benefiting others, never does any harm, really. It never does any harm at all. And even if, you benefit in the process, actually that doesn't cause any harm either.